Committee on State Government Innovation and Veterans will be in order. Today is Wednesday, February 22nd, 2012. Trying to read without my glasses this afternoon. The first item on the agenda is Senate File 1577. Senator Newman is here with us. We're going to be speaking on the constitutional amendment for photographic identification, photo ID requirement. Before we get started, Senator Newman, I would like to have Senate counsel briefly go over our committee's jurisdiction of this bill. So, Ms. James.
Mr. Chair and members, this bill is before this committee because we have jurisdiction over the Secretary of State and its budgets, issues relating to the Secretary of State and its budget. And this bill implicates the Secretary of State because it is an election provision.
Right. Thank you very much. Members and those of you in the audience, this bill has already received 5.5 hours of public testimony in the Committee on Local Government and Elections. So it is my intent to stay strictly within our committee jurisdiction while we are discussing Senate File 1577 this afternoon. Members of the committee and those in attendance, it is also my intent that public discussion on the jurisdiction of the bill will end no later than 2 o'clock this afternoon. While we will be allowing public testimony on the bill, I will need to stop, and I will stop any testimony that does not pertain to the impact on the Secretary of State of putting the constitutional amendment on the ballot. With that being said, Senator Newman, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and committee members. I'm happy to be back in front of your committee. I think first, Mr. Chairman, if we could, I believe there should be an A22 amendment floating around out there.
Senator Daley.
I move
Senator
that,
Daley,
I move
that okay.
The A22.
Thank you very much. Senator Daley moves the A22 amendment. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Amendment prevails to the amended bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, I appreciate you putting the A22 amendment before us. So the bill is now in the form that I want to talk to you about. This has been an ongoing process, the bill seems to change, every time we have a committee hearing on it, and I think that's probably good because what we're trying to do is refine it make clear what the legislative intent will be. So very briefly, just to try and help you, I'm going to explain to you what the changes are in the A22 amendment versus the first engrossment that came out of the last committee hearing. First of all, in Section A in the first engrossment, I took out the language which stated and whose eligibility to vote has been established under this section. That was at lines 11 and 12 of the First Amendment, and I took that out because I was convinced that it was simply redundant verbiage. I moved the first sentence at the first engrossment up into section.
Oh, wait, sorry. I
didn't up into section 1A because it spoke in terms of eligibility verification, and I just felt it was clearer to put that language up into section A. I added the word state to the eligibility verification, so it now reads the substantially equivalent state eligibility verification. On your amendment, that's at line 18. At line 21 of the A22 amendment, I changed the word from accepted to counted. next, in section B, on the issue of provisional ballots versus absentee ballots. In the first engrossment, that language was contained in one sentence. And what I have done now is I broke it out into two different sentences. And again, I did it for the purposes of trying to clarify what is intended by this legislation. And specifically, it has never been my intention from the beginning of this bill to in any way prevent same-day registration because I believe provisional balloting will take care of that problem. It has never been my intention to prohibit in any way absentee balloting. And but there seemed to be some persistence that that's what was trying to be attempted. And so I decided to break that out into two different sentences in an effort to clarify it. I would also indicate that in the last hearing there was a comment made by the Secretary of State's office that same-day voters will be, or I'm sorry, same-day voter registrants will be all placed in the category of provisional ballots. And that is not my intent. If same-day registrants show up with the proper identification, their vote will be counted on Election Day. The provisional ballots are ballots that will be utilized in the event someone shows up to vote and does not have the proper identification. And in that case, it would be my intent that the legislature next year would enact enabling legislation where they could come back and prove their identity after the fact. But the difference is that that provisional ballot isn't counted until proof of identity is made. In the first engrossment, there was a provision which provided that coming back with provisional or after having voted provisionally, there was language that a voter would have 10 days to come back to the election official in order to prove that identity. I have taken that language out, and we are simply going to leave it as provided by law. I changed the effective date from 2014 to 2013, primarily because I feel that, you know, this matter will go on the ballot in November. The first elections that folks will have will be in June of 2013. That's a period of 8 months that will allow people to obtain the necessary voter identification, and I guess I just feel that that's a sufficient amount of time to obtain the voter ID. From the position of local officials, I am very aware of the fact that there are some local officials that do not necessarily agree with an effective date of June of 2013. And I guess my feeling on that would be that this is simply an ID matter that would be where you would be required to show an ID when you come to vote. I don't anticipate that there's going to be a great deal of extra work on the part of the local officials, but there again, you know, if my assumption is incorrect, I would certainly be willing to talk to the local officials at any time that they want. To date, I have heard from some townships, but I have not heard from cities or counties on this issue. The next change, Mr. Chairman and members, is that I removed the severability clause that was in the former amendment in the first engrossment. And I guess, you know, I've flip-flopped on this issue as to whether to put it in or not. But ultimately, I'm coming to the conclusion that given the fact that this is a constitutional amendment and not a bill, that it might not be appropriate to put a severability clause in. But I do want to make sure that legislative intent would be that if any portion of this were this bill were to be found unconstitutional under the federal constitution, that a severability issue could be raised. And then the last question is in the question portion of the A22 amendment under online, I think it's 22. No, I'm sorry. On the A22 amendment, it's line 31. I took out the word accepted and inserted the word counted. So it's a ballot cast or counted. And that is just for continuity's sake. Counted is the word that is used in Section 1. With that, Mr. Chairman and members, those are the changes, as I can best summarize for you, between what you saw in the first engrossment and the A22 amendment, and I will do my best to answer any questions that the members may have. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Ms. Senator Newman. Do we have any questions for Senator Newman on those changes?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hayden.
Mr. Chair, I have an amendment, and I don't know when you'd like for me to offer that. It's kind of at your pleasure, but I wanted to let you know that I did have one.
Okay. You certainly can offer it at any time.
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, I would like to move the A24 amendment.
Senator Hayden. Hayden, do we have – let's wait until we get the amendment passed around. Senator Hayden, I believe everyone has their copy now.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Newman. I'd like to offer the A24 amendment. The A24 amendment deletes is a delete everything amendment on line 1.3, page 1 after line 34, insert section 3 repealer. On 1.5, it says laws 2011, chapter 88, section 1 and 2 are repealed. 1.6, effective date. This section is effective the day following the final enactment. 1.7, amend the title accordingly. Mr. Chair, this is the amendment to remove the anti-marriage amendment from the ballot. Mr. Chair, removing the anti-marriage amendment from the ballot, I believe, is the right thing to do. Our Constitution should be used to expand our freedoms, not restrict them. Additionally, adding the amendment to the ballot costs money. Traditionally, we have not appropriated money from amendments, and the cost absorbed by the Secretary of State's Office of Local Government, this causes me great concern. As families across Minnesota knows, every dollar counts. By eliminating the anti-marriage amendment, we could help the Secretary of State's office offset the cost of the voter ID amendment and save taxpayer money. At a time when we need to be exercising fiscal restraint, we should not be spending taxpayer money on unnecessary constitutional amendments, especially those that are overreaching and infringe on our rights. I encourage my colleagues to be good stewards of the taxpayer dollars and vote to strike the marriage amendment from the ballot in order to offset the cost of the proposed voter ID amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Hayden. Senator Newman, any comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Hayden, if I understand your amendment correctly, it really doesn't have anything to do with the voter ID amendment that I am bringing forward. And so the voter ID amendment is not – I am not the chief author on. And so the best I can tell you is that I would view the A24 amendment as being irrelevant, and I would therefore oppose it.
Thank you. Senator Gazelka.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'd like a roll call on this.
Roll call has been requested and granted. Any further discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Ortman.
Is the amendment in order?
Senator Ortman, based on the fact that this repeal or this amendment has to do with a constitutional amendment, we are working on that, and so I'm going to allow it at this time.
Thank you.
Any further discussion? If not, Secretary, take the roll.
Senator Carlson?
No.
Senator Cohen?
Yes.
Senator Daley?
No.
Senator Hayden?
Yes.
Senator Gazelka?
No.
Senator Goodwin?
Yes.
Senator Lilly?
No.
Senator Olson?
No.
Senator Ortman?
No.
Senator Thompson?
No.
Senator Torres-Ray?
Yes.
Senator Wieger?
Yes.
Senator Perry?
No. With a five, there were eight no's, five yeas, the amendment does not prevail. We have testifiers that we would like to get to, and I believe the first testifier we have is Secretary of State Mark Ritchie.
Mr. Chairman, I have a couple of questions from the author, if I may.
Yes. Secretary of State, you can come up and join Senator Newman at the table. Senator Torres-Ray.
Senator Newman, I have a question about line 111. It seems to me that if this... I want to have a sense of the number, or at least the proposed number of ID cards that need to be issued. It says the state must make photographic ID available to eligible individuals. So that could you define for me eligible individuals would be people born in the U.S. that are 18. Could you, this is difficult for me to understand this language. So the state provides, so two questions to it. Eligible individuals, I would like for you to explain to me what that means.
Senator Torres-Ray, I'm going to stop here because I just don't, I'm not seeing as this as relevant to this and what's happening with the Secretary of State, that question. Just bear with me. Mm-hmm. So before I want to continue, I think what we need to do is listen to the Secretary of State, because we're here to see how a constitutional amendment, folks, not photo ID, not marriage amendment, we're here to find out what a constitutional amendment will create for the Secretary of State. And so that's the path that we are going to go down here today. And with all due respect, Senator, I think that's getting off the path that I believe is the right direction. And I think for the most part, being that this will be going to finance, those are the type of questions, because I see your question is one that will evoke a cost in my mind.
Right.
Okay? Is it, okay. So, Secretary
Mr. Rich, Chair, one second on that topic.
Senator Goodwin.
I just wanted to remind the Chair that we have a new bill in front of us now, and so this particular bill, this Delete All Amendment, has not been heard in any committee yet. So I think my advice would be it's fair game to discuss this new language so everybody understands that even though we did have a five-hour hearing in the past, it wasn't on this language.
Well, it's, Senator Goodwin, with all due respect, it's substantially the same, and we're not going to go down that path today. We're going to deal with how this affects the Secretary of State's office. So, Secretary Ritchie, please.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members.
I want to focus very specifically on the chairman's narrowing of this hearing to the impacts on our Office of the Secretary of State. And I want to also focus it even further to the two main components that would affect our office in the language. The language has changed. We are very happy that some of the early language about identical and some of those things have changed. So we're, you know, trying to keep abreast of the changes that have occurred. But there are two core elements that affect our office, of course. One is the...
I want to clarify one more thing here, Secretary of State. We are talking about the impacts on your office right now. We're not going into the impacts that could happen in out years. We're talking about the impacts here because, as I said, when this does get to finance, I'm sure there are going to be some questions on the impact of current year, you know, what it will take for this constitutional amendment, because I do know that there will be testifiers probably show up in finance from cities, counties questioning the impact down the road.
Well, okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just focusing on what our office is looking at in terms of the constitutional amendment, and please cut me off if our planning. The ability to implement by June of 2013 is the thing that we think about. So there are seven components of being able to do that in that time frame. And let me do them quickly because I know you're on a very, very short time. The first is the creation of a provisional balloting system. This is an alteration of our statewide voter registration system. It's never been done in an extremely short period of time as we are contemplating, but vendors are very available, and this is something that is we can contemplate it, but planning it for such a short period of time will require a significant expense and a planning expense on our part. Second, the cost related to the training. Training is our responsibility, and, of course, provisional balloting system is quite a different system, so the cost related to that. The third, the federal government mandates a tracking system, kind of like UPS, Federal Express, on provisional ballots. We do not have this. This would have to be created. Again, that tracking system we have for some absentee ballots, and so there are some adaptive things that can take place, but this is a different because it's a federal mandate. The cost related to public education, again, on a very short timeline. Supreme Courts of various states have weighed in on this. It's typically the Office of Secretary of State with that responsibility. Just letting people know about the availability of the free ID. Indiana's a bigger state, but they have fewer voters normally. They provided about 700,000, so they had to get out the information to 700,000 people in the first few years. That'd be a lot of work, staff costs, and the cost of adoption of administrative rules. Judge Lipman is here, and we love the fact that they are a very low-cost provider of administrative rulemaking, but it still is an expensive process to do. We would need extensive rulemaking, however this was implemented. Those kind of core costs to us are alongside of the costs that we know we would then have to administer in the procedure of provisional ballots. For example, there's a, depending on the day and the month, something between 20 and 40,000 people who've lost their wallets and have not received their license yet. So they would be in that provisional ballot category. If it's 10 days, if it's 7 days, each state is quite different, but there would be a 7 to 10 day, some period of time after the election, where those provisional ballots would be sitting, waiting for the DMV or whomever to provide. There are 84,000 people currently without IDs. Many are older, cannot get what we would think of as a traditional ID. Our office would have responsibility for the information and education of those voters who would essentially not be able to participate in the normal process. To the extent that these things become the task of our office, that's a different matter than those costs that you properly said are someplace else, the local, the citizen, that kind of thing. So we're just looking at the core cost to our office itself. we provided a fiscal note about an earlier version. Of course, there's cost to, you know, just putting it on the ballot, that kind of thing. But when we consider implementation by next June, then we have in our minds the work it would take our office to do. We haven't been able to figure out an exact cost, and we will, you know, kind of scramble to do that. But I've laid out the sort of the main areas that we see the costs coming to us. When you create a huge new provisional balloting system, you create a new system within the entire voter registration, and you have quite a period of time after the elections when you don't know the outcome of the election. Just speaking personally, I've been in that spot, and you might need an extra communication staff or two in that first week to handle you know, that kind of situation. But it's a maybe a minor thing in the larger sphere, but it is a very nerve-wracking period of time to not know the outcome of the election. I look forward to an opportunity to present what I think is a very low-cost, very effective other idea, alternative, that our office has been working on with a number of people. But today is not the day for that. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and happy to take any questions.
You know, I knew you were going to slip in that back part there, Secretary.
I just
knew you were going to go there.
Okay.
Do we have questions for the Secretary of State? Senator Wigger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Secretary. I believe your testimony was that approximately 80,000 people might be potentially disenfranchised, which is about the size of a Senate district.
That's not what he said.
Senator Wigger, you're going down a path we're not going to go down.
Mr. Chair, on the cost for 80,000, in addition to the cost that you're looking at.
Senator Wigger, I'm going to remind you again, you're going down a path. We are here specifically to talk about a constitutional amendment and what it's going to create for the Secretary of State to get on the ballot. You are taking this to the next step, which I've already explained will be looked at, I'm sure, in finance when this bill moves in that direction.
Understood.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, one
comment. Senator Goodwin.
I do believe that in finance, which I'm on, rarely are we able to discuss the policy in the bill because then we're told that it's only about the money in the bill and not about the policy. So I don't know if you have something worked out with Senator Roebling, but if you don't, we're not going to be able to hear this these exact provisions in here and in that committee and discuss them. So I hope you two have worked this out, because otherwise this bill, very important bill to the state of Minnesota, is not going to get a full and open discussion.
I hear you. We have spoke with Senator Roebling. This bill will be heard. And as I mentioned, with these few, a couple of minor changes, this bill is significantly the same that did get its 5.5-hour hearing previously in state government. Do we have any questions for Secretary Ritchie? Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Secretary Ritchie, you had mentioned, and maybe I misunderstood this, it sounded like you were saying that there was some different kinds of ballots or something that would have to be prepared. My understanding of this language is all ballots would be the same as they've always been. It's just that in order to get your ballot, you have to provide a photo ID. So could you maybe explain that a little bit further? I didn't quite get that.
Secretary Ritchie.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Carlson, yes, thank you very much. In line 1.19 and 1.20, the new and I would say very, very new and very substantial change is the creation of a provisional balloting system for the state of Minnesota. We've never had this. It has been a blessing in the sense that it has kept us from being under the supervision of the federal U.S. Department of Justice. And when you don't have provisional ballots, your life is less complicated and has less federal intervention. But once you create a provisional ballot system, then certain federal laws that mandate certain ways of treating them kick into place. For instance, and I only reference the ones that affects our office in terms of money, you're required to create a tracking system within your statewide voter registration system, similar to what FedEx and UPS does with packages, but you're tracking those provisional ballots under a federally mandated, and those are supervised by the voting rights section of the U.S. Department of Justice. And so once you go down the road of creating a provisional balloting system for the state, you have some tremendous effects in terms of your internal system because you have a separate provisional ballot. That ballot cannot be counted until you show up. If you're in Kuwait, it's hard to show up. There are all kinds of issues. But more importantly, to the cost for me, which is our narrow focus today, I have to change the voter registration system. I have to add a tracking system. I have to watch Department of Justice over my back. And I have to communicate as effectively as I can with voters about how that system works and why they want to avoid that system if they can.
Mr. Chairman? So,
a follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Senator Carlson.
So you're suggesting that a voter would cast a provisional ballot because they didn't have an ID and then run to Kuwait? Because all of this has to do with is in voting in person. It's very clear that this is in-person voting. It does not affect mail-in ballots. It does not affect absentee ballots. It doesn't affect military that vote by – so I guess I'm confused by the
– Yeah. Well, so
Senator
would,
Ritchie. Oh, or excuse sorry. Me, Secretary of State.
I'm sorry. Mr. Chairman, Senator Carlson, the triggering for voting by provisional is your inability in in-person to present a photo identification or in the case of mail-in to be able to provide a state government, that's a change, state government issued proof of identity. If you are not meeting either of those two triggers, your ballot is only cast provisionally and not counted, and you have a limited period of time. In the prior version, it was 10 days. Every state varies. And in that process, then, you have to either provide that state government-issued proof of identity or present that state-issued photo ID. So who might get triggered in that situation is somebody who has lost or had their wallet stolen and is in the time period when that has not been provided back by the Department of Motor Vehicles. In a 15-day time period, which is optimistic, it's about 20,000 people. If it takes a month, it's about 40. But there could be other reasons. For example, if you have the wrong address on your driver's license right now, we have 131,000 people with the wrong address. So you come in, you say, no, I've ordered another, or I'll go in and get my driver's license. So perhaps you have time in your schedule to go down to DMV and get your updated driver's license or the address corrected. You get a little slip. They clip your license. You can come back to the county courthouse or to the city clerk's office, take care of it. But if you are home and you're a truck driver and you're an over-the-road truck driver and you're home for election day and you're in and your only way to have your vote counted is that you have to do something with DMV and then go back to the county courthouse or to the city clerk's office, we know nationally that a third of provisionals are never counted. I think in Indiana it's only 17% are. One component of that is just the hassle factor for people going back, you know, back home if they're gone. I don't know all the provisions in other states, but I know that creating a provisional ballot system, one of the reasons it's under such scrutiny by Department of Justice is that it tends to create a second hurdle for a number of voters, and they have to figure out a way to jump over that second hurdle.
Thank
All
you.
Right. Thank you very much.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Senator Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I hope this is in order. I'm trying to follow kind of what are the questions we should or shouldn't ask the Secretary. Mr. Secretary and Senator, in line 1.19, it talks about, or actually in 1.21, an absentee ballot shall be counted if government-issued identification or government-issued proof of identity is presented or prescribed or provided as prescribed by law. Senator, can you help me to understand what kind of take me through the mechanisms if I vote as in an absentee ballot and if this bill goes into law. How does that flow? How does that work to ensure that if I am in Kuwait or if I am out of town on business legitimately, how does my vote get counted? I'm not sure, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure. I don't sit on the Finance Committee, nor do I sit in local gov. Secretary Ritchie kind of talked about it. Senator Carlson kind of brought it up. So I'm just not quite sure how we go through this bill if we can't get any questions answered. And I think that's a legitimate question.
And with that being said, just that much leniency here because Secretary Ritchie started this. I'm kidding, yeah. Secretary. Okay.
Mr. Chairman,
so,
thank you.
Please, yes.
Senator Hayden, just our cost would be keeping the voters informed of the situation and so they know what they need to do to get there and after, and redoing the statewide voter registration system to handle the new provisional ballots and the tracking process required by federal law. How it would work for mail-in and absentee voters who could not present the proof of identity is only to be stipulated in law, so it's not – I have no way to know how that would affect our office financially, which is the question today.
Right. Senator Hayden.
So we don't quite know how that would work yet because we haven't developed that. I really am
correctly
a little confused,
because so. There will be stipulations being developed next year in law to address many of these items, and you there's in my mind there's no way at this point in time that we can get to that point without knowing whether or not this gets on the ballot. Once it gets on the ballot and the decision is made, at that point in time, the legislature will have to come back then and address specifically what you're speaking of and what the Secretary.
Well, Mr. Chair.
So, Mr. Chair, that then says that then the citizens who got to vote on this, if it does make it to the ballot, don't actually know what they're voting on, because maybe that might be a consideration if they are going to vote yes or no, if they know that their son or daughter in Kuwait could mail in their ID and their ballot at the same time, or a photograph of that. I mean, I just don't know how. I just don't know how to tell the people who I represent how the bill is going to work if we are going to put it on the ballot for them to say yes or no, and then backfill that with a bunch of laws and provisions that they don't know. I'm looking at Senator Cohen and others that have really worked on this bill, but I'm thoroughly confused, and I think the electorate would be confused, sir.
Mr. Chairman.
Excuse me.
Mr. Chairman.
Excuse me. We'll go to Senator Carlson first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To that point, this is very clear language. This speaks about at the time of voting in person. This has absolutely no effect on mail-in or absentee voting. That remains exactly the same. And to keep referring to mail-in and absentee ballots and having to provide some sort of mail-in photo ID is just erroneous. This bill very specifically, in my mind, speaks specifically of in-person voting. I don't know why we even have a discussion about the rather.
Thank you. I believe Senator Olson and then Senator Cohen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'd like to ask the question that you said we were supposed to be determining, and that is, what is the cost of putting it on the ballot? I'm trying to remember, and I've got a good memory, but it's short. When you get the paper ballot, generally you've got two sides of one sheet that usually get all of the contested elections. And I'm trying to remember: are the constitutional amendments on a separate piece of paper or ballot, or are they part of the continuum on the regular ballot that people vote on, either with paper ballot or fill in the blanks and feed it through an electronic system?
Secretary Ritchie.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, if you put a lot of constitutional amendments on, it pushes it to a second ballot, but that's a fairly unusual situation. We estimated the cost at around $100,000 for the extra time and all the putting it together and that sort of thing. But that has happened, but it's very unusual, and that would be up to the legislature to determine how many and then how far down that went. In one instance, last time in Washington County, there was a tremendously long ballot because there were a lot of people in a very unusual circumstance running for a judge seat. So you don't know for sure, but typically it's going to stay on the front and back of, you know, one sheet of paper, and we're hopeful for that.
So Mr. Chairman,
Senator Olson,
Secretary Ritchie, the additional cost would really only be if it drives it onto a second piece of paper. If you're doing it on one, obviously you're the same type is going to be printed regardless of what precinct or whatever else.
Secretary Ritchie,
Mr. Chairman,
that
Senator Olson,
a great additional cost.
It's minor. It's the extra cost of the reporting, the election day reporting. You have to program and make sure that you have that done. But, yes, the physical part of putting it on the same ballot and then reporting it on the night of the election is relatively minor.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, could one more. I'd like to clarify with Senator Carlson. We are especially drawn to line 1.17, which says that all voters must be subject to substantially equivalent state eligibility verification prior to a ballot being cast or counted. Substantially equivalent is a replacement for identical. We're very happy because this allows for some alternatives, perhaps, but all voters must be subject to the same, let's say, eligibility verification prior to ballot being cast or counted. And there are a number of circumstances when voters who are voting through the mail would not meet that all voters must meet requirement. Therefore, they would have to come back and the ballot would be provisional and they would have to come in and meet those. And so that's why from the reading we have of the bill, it applies to all voters, and all voters must meet either identical, that's the House language, or substantially equivalent eligibility verification.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, I did want to come back to a comment made by Secretary Ritchie that it would cost about $100,000 to put this matter on the ballot. And I will tell you that I have to date not seen or heard that figure. Parenthetically, I have heard the figure of $2,000 being floated around, in conversations to put this matter on the ballot. But I guess it really doesn't matter because I have received a copy of a letter dated February 21st from MMB. It was a letter addressed to Senator Ortman, Senator Marty, Senator Roebling, and Senator Cohn, raising certain questions regarding, the fiscal considerations. And just so that you understand, I did go down this morning and talked to Senator Roebling, and it's at that point, I literally requested her to pull this matter into the Finance Committee so that we could have a hearing on the questions that are being raised regarding the fiscal considerations. And I am hoping that between now and when that hearing is going to occur, and she told me around March 1st, that I will be able to come up with some further information for you on things like how much is it going to cost to put it on the ballot.
Thank you. We're going to hear from a question from Senator Cohen. We are going to move on to public testimony after that. Senator Cohen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of quick comments. First, a matter of personal privilege relative to Senator Hayden, if you don't mind. Senator Hayden, you, in asking your question, made some reference to people who've worked on this legislation, like Senator Cohen. I think you said, please don't give me any responsibility for this legislation. I have not worked on it. Apology accepted. Mr. Chairman, my quick comment is I was certainly prepared to follow the admonition of the chair relative to debate in committee on this bill, but Mr. Chairman, your response about, well, we'll just have to kind of wait and see if it passes, then we'll figure it out. I think the cliche is buying a pig in a poke. I'm a little bit unsettled by your comment to the extent that we just accept in good faith we're going to figure all this out. So that concerns me.
Senator Cohen, as I mentioned early on, we're here to address, and I've let some leniency happen. We're here to specifically address what it takes to get this a constitutional amendment on the ballot, and that's what Secretary Ritchie is for. We're not here to decide after the fact, specifically on legislation that could come out of the next legislature, not this one. And that's the specific item that we're trying to address here. I've allowed some leniency in a policy side, though a little bit, and that's where I'm holding to. I'm interested in hearing what Secretary Ritchie had to say, because that's where that falls under our committee here, Senator Cohen. So with that, did you have one final comment,
Mr.
Secretary?
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted you to know that on the 16th of February, our office's fiscal note on just putting it on the ballot, sent back, approved by the MMB folks who look over us, and went over to the senator's office, but I just gave him another copy. The short version and the longer version depend on how many constitutional amendments do go forward, but I will make sure that all of the committee members have this same fiscal note back, but again, it'll come up in the Finance Committee hearing, but just we'll get it to you right away. You know, it's a trivial amount in one respect if it's just the reporting. It's a little bit more if it goes long, but it is only part of the things that will affect our office, and it's in this fiscal note that came out on the 16th.
Thank you very much. And we do have folks that had signed up and wanted to testify, so we can the person I have next is Carolyn Jackson. If Carolyn is here, in a thank you, Secretary.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. My name is Carolyn Jackson. I'm the lobbying coordinator for the ACLU of Minnesota.
Before we get started. Sure. Please remember that we are specifically talking about getting how a constitutional amendment gets on the ballot here.
Senator, I do have a question for you about that. My testimony is about two different aspects of this. The first is that is our reading of this constitutional amendment that it changes the structure of state government. And if it's not heard in this committee, I don't know where that concern would be raised. The second one is about the effect on the Secretary of State's office of putting this on the ballot and the lawsuits ensuing from that action, not from anything that would happen after the November 2012 election. So those are the two parts of my testimony. But I do have a question for you. If this does create a new state, it's a constitutional amendment that changes the structure of our state government. And if it's not heard here, where would I present that testimony?
You have me intrigued right now. So I'm going to let you move forward. And the reason I'm going to let you go, because you used the word state government.
Yes.
I know this has been heard extensively in local government. But I guess I do want to hear, and I'll allow you some leniency that way.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I will try and keep it brief. The ACLU of Minnesota is the Minnesota affiliate of the ACLU, the nation's oldest civil rights organization, with over 500,000 members nationwide and over 8,500 members statewide in Minnesota. We are a privately funded nonprofit, and our mission is to protect the Bill of Rights in the federal and Minnesota constitutions, including the fundamental right to vote. The constitutional amendment proposed in Senate File 1577 would require a voter to present a photo ID to vote. This bill creates a mess. It creates a newly mandated program without any guides for implementation or cost. Because this bill comes in the form of a constitutional amendment, it is a change to voting rights unprecedented in the history of the state or in the nation, and it comes without explanation or detail. The Minnesota Constitution currently has only two mandated programs, a general and uniform system of public schools and a public highway system. Senate File 1577 creates a new mandate that the state must make photographic identification available to eligible individuals at no charge. Article 13, Section 1, which created the system of public schools, ordered the legislature to make provisions by taxation or otherwise to pay for schools. Article 14, which mandates a public highway system, contains no less than three sources of revenue to pay for roads. Currently, the state of Minnesota owes the public schools approximately $3.5 billion.
Ms. Jackson?
Yes.
I don't think anyone here needs a history lesson. I get to your point. I said this intrigues me about how it's going to change state government. And that's really what I want to hear right now, okay, to let you continue.
Well, it creates a new mandate. There are only two currently. We have schools and roads, both of which are underfunded. This would take priority over funding schools and funding roads, because if we do not provide a free ID, it's an unconstitutional poll tax. And so before we can begin to pay for roads and schools, we'll have to pay for this new mandate. And that's something for the committee to consider. And the other thing is that all of those, there have been 29 constitutional amendments since the Constitution was updated in 1974. Of those 29 constitutional amendments, 27 of them came with enabling legislation. The two that did not were the ones passed in 2006 in the transportation bill, which the governor vetoed, but because there were constitutional amendments in the enabling legislation, they went ahead and went on the ballot. It was 2006. But every other constitutional amendment that's been passed since 1974 came with enabling legislation. So this is really virgin territory that we're stepping into here. And I just raise that issue. I don't know what you want to do with that, but it's never been done before, at least not since 1974, that we would create a new state program without an explanation. So I raise that to you because there will be legal challenges. The Crawford decision found the Indiana's voter ID law constitutional on its face, but there's never been an applied challenge that's gone to court. And that is when there are actual people involved. Currently, there is an as-applied challenge in federal court in Wisconsin. The named person in that lawsuit would be the Secretary of State here in Minnesota. And it's far from settled law. The South Carolina, the Justice Department found that it had racial voter ID had racial disparities, and it blocked it. That's in litigation. There is a court case in state law, in state court in Missouri. Mississippi is facing federal litigation on this, and there are two state law cases in Wisconsin. So this is not a matter which is settled law. There will be lawsuits. The state of Minnesota can expect a court challenge. A very simple, straightforward court challenge costs about $100,000. This will not be simple or straightforward. I said the part about the enabling legislation, and the other thing that the state should consider is that because a lot of these terms that are in this constitutional amendment, such as government issued and substantially equivalent, are come with no explanation, this is going to create a cottage industry of voting lawsuits. Every time, no matter what the enabling legislation is, every time someone is turned away from voting because they don't have an ID, they're going to challenge things like, what does government issued mean? What does substantially equivalent mean? Because this is in our Constitution. So you can say, well, it's going to be as prescribed by law, but then you'll say, does it match? And it will create a cottage industry of lawsuits, sort of ongoing every time someone's turned away. Because it creates a new unfunded mandate.
Ms. Jackson, I think we get that part.
Two sentences left. May I say them, please? It creates a new unfunded mandate and subjects the state to substantial legal costs. We urge the committee to vote no.
Thank you very much. Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, I hope you'll share for just a minute. I was trying to follow along. I know we've had lots of constitutional amendments, mm-hmm, and for me that's when we ask the voters in a question of a higher authority. Is there something we're missing with the overall construction of our state, and the voters get a chance to weigh in and say, we're missing something, or we need to change something in a very fundamental way.
Right.
But I'm not sure we need to ask them all of the details about how we accomplish their goals, and if you'll let me finish.
Sure.
So, for instance, we have a constitution with mandates for education, for transportation, for public safety, as you said. The Constitution does not provide all the details, nor were those details provided when we adopted the Constitution. There may have been some sources of revenues that were identified, but if you look at all of our statute books, and what's happened since, we continue every single year to further refine and clarify what we mean when we say we're going to provide K-12 education to every Minnesotan. And I would say that this is not a question of first impression. I mean, I do think that we should be asking voters, is this important to you? I don't think we have to ask them, if it's important to you, how do we implement every last single detail in order to accomplish your goal? I think that's what we do after the voters have spoken and said, this is our common goal. And I would bring back the recent example of the sales tax on the cultural heritage and outdoors tax. We certainly did not adopt a method for seeking review and recommendations and distribution methods when we asked the question. We didn't have that. Now, we may have had some of the enacting language, but we certainly didn't have every detail ironed out. Now, I know that this question is hard to define because we don't have all those questions. I think Senator Hayden makes a good point that it will be hard to say, well, how will this be implemented? But I think the higher purpose here is to ask the voters, is this important and should we implement it? That comes first. The next part follows, hopefully in successive legislative sessions.
Mr. Chairman, Senator.
Ms. Jackson.
I think I didn't make myself clear that I'm not saying that the voters should have to vote on a whole long statute, but when they have voted on a constitutional amendment in the past, at the time that the constitutional amendment was passed, there was also enabling legislation so that members of the legislature, when they were asked by people, how does this work, they would say, this is what the enabling legislation said. And with the legacy amendment, I know that it was not completely hammered out, but there was enabling legislation with it. I believe in two different ways. There was legislation that was passed early on in February that allocated it, and then also in the finance bills that were passed later that year, there were allocations accounting for how the legacy money would be spent. So there were some guidelines. It was not on the ballot. You're correct. But and then as far as the funding goes, in the schools section and also in the transportation section, there is specifically language accounting for the state making provision to pay for what they've mandated. In the school one, it's briefer. The legislature shall make such provisions by taxation or otherwise as will secure a thorough and efficient system of public schools throughout the state. And as I began to say, we're not doing that currently. We're in
thank
debt
you.
To the schools.
Mr. Thank you, Ms. Jackson. We're going to move on to our next testifier. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, can I clarify a procedural thing?
Senator Olson.
The passage of statutory language along with the constitutional amendment perhaps can be used for education purposes, but it technically isn't binding because the constitutional amendment does not have to be signed by the governor. The implementing language for the constitutional amendment has to go through a statutory process, which includes the legislature and a signature by the governor. And so, I do recall having voted not when I got here on constitutional amendments that had been passed by the people in the previous prior election, and then we acted on the implementing language. And that can be changed, even if it were sent, if it were put in place for educational purposes, that we cannot bind the next legislature on that.
Correct. Thank you, Senator Earl. Thank you, Ms. Jackson. Dan McGrath. Welcome to the committee, Mr. McGrath. And again, I will bring up that we are focusing on to the extent of what a constitutional amendment will create for the Secretary of State. I think you get that, so please be specific. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Dan McGrath, Executive Director of Minnesota Majority. Just in brief, I'm surprised that this didn't actually come up so far in the committee hearing. In terms of the impact the amendment itself will have on the Office of the Secretary of State is really pretty minimal. It's nothing unusual or extraordinary. There have been dozens of constitutional amendments put on the ballot by the Secretary of State's office over the last 20 or 30 years. But what the Secretary of State's responsibility is going to be is to design the ballot, and he's going to determine where the amendment questions on the ballot will be placed. The legacy amendment was front and center when that was on the ballot. I don't know where this particular question will wind up. It could be on the front, could be on the back. That's up to the Secretary of State, but something to consider. And the Secretary of State also has the responsibility to name the ballot question. So those are some things to contemplate as far as what the Secretary's responsibilities are going to be. Once enacted, hard to say what's going to happen. It's going to be left to the next legislature. There will be an opportunity at that time for the public to engage in robust public debate and provide testimony on exactly how it's implemented. So I don't think that's really going to be a major problem for this committee to consider. And with that, I'll conclude my remarks, but I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. McGrath. We're going to move on. I have two more people that I see have requested that we're allowing, and one is Ken Johnson. If Mr. Johnson is here. Welcome, Mr. Johnson. And again, I remind you we're being specific here as to the amendment and the Secretary of State. Mm-hmm. So please make sure that your comments are down that path. And please introduce yourself first.
My name is Ken Johnson. As you see, I'm taking time off work. I'm losing money. I'm not being paid to be here like many of you. I'm taking time off because I believe this is an extremely important issue, an issue that, unfortunately, our governor vetoed. And so we are on a course, the only course allowed the rest of the citizens of Minnesota, and that is to have an amendment put on the Constitution. It would be nice if our governor would have seen things
the way the citizens of Minnesota would like to see them.
But no.
Excuse me, sir.
Yeah.
Senator Cohen, did you have...
Well, Mr. Chairman, you told all of us we could only talk about the Secretary of State. Is Mr. Johnson's testimony relative to the Secretary of State?
It will be in one moment.
I did allow Ms. Jackson some leniency, so I'm going to allow this testifier just a little bit more, and I'm sure he'll get to his point.
Go directly to the Secretary of State's testimony. First off, the truck driver, an example he gave. Now, I don't know of any truck driver that would get into his truck and start it without a valid driver's license. I mean, the guy would be literally insane to drive his truck without a valid driver's license. So that eliminates any truck drivers. They'll all always have a valid license, and they'll always be able to vote. There's a proposal for a picture ID for welfare recipients. And if they had a picture ID, they would be able to use the government-issued ID to vote.
Correct. And Mr.
Go on to the next one.
Mr. Johnson.
Yeah?
You're really off. I get what you're saying. I think everybody understands what you're saying. But you're off track here when we're specifically talking about a constitutional amendment and what it takes for the Secretary of State to get that on the ballot. Mm-hmm. And that's where we're at. You're out in testimony that has been given already in local government.
Okay. Then I will go on to points more direct. These points were points I've taken as listening to the Secretary of State give his testimony. And this was basically a rebuttal.
Okay. Right. And I think I'm going to stop you there, Mr. Johnson, because we get your point. We understand what you're trying to say, sir, and I appreciate you. I would like to have you contact my office with your information, sir. I appreciate you taking the time off. And it's unfortunate that we're just not going down that path today.
Well, can I another rebuttal that is brought up about the sheet? I served as an election judge. And I would like to say that you can save a lot of time for the people who's running these polls, okay? And I get paid, so this is a cost to the Secretary of State's office. This is a cost. And we started at 6 in the morning. We ended at 10 at night. And if you had voter ID, we probably could get, and we only get 2 15-minute breaks,
right,
enough to go to the bathroom.
Thank
we
you,
would have
sir.
A little bit easier job.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate
Good
that.
Job.
And excuse me, Senator Hayden. Thank you for your testimony. I'm sure Secretary Ritchie would like to hear from you about more efficiency, but we will end your testimony here now. And I truly thank you for.
Can I comment on the ACLU's comments?
Thank you. No, sir.
Please.
No, sir. We're not going to go down that path.
Well, they shouldn't have been here anyways.
Thank
but
you,
it
sir.
Was nice to hear that they like to threaten
thank
people
you.
Still.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our next testifier will be William Reichert, Minnesota Voters Alliance. Mr. Reichert, are you here?
So, Mr. Chair, I have a question.
Senator Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So as our testifiers come up and they're kind of on your track and off your track, but as they kind of bring other issues into discussion, I think it's a little tough for me to sit here and not be able to at least ask them follow-up questions. I want to make sure that as they make their statements, they're not misinformation that they're kind of sending out to the public. So I would really hope that we could stick to what you really wanted this hearing to be. Or if not, then, Mr. Chair, we should get an opportunity to at least ask a question of some of the testifiers to clarify the statements.
Correct, Senator Hayden, and I can't agree with you more. I don't know what they're going to testify as. They have not written it out, so I could have pre-read that. So I'm specifically for like Mr. Johnson, who came, took a day off. I want to allow as much leniency until I can gather exactly what path they're going down. I get you. I understand what you're saying, Senator Hayden, thank you for that comment. And so, Mr. Reichert, I think you've heard discussion here, and you know exactly where we're going. And this will be our last public testifier that I have here today. And so please proceed.
Thank you, Mr.
State your name first.
My name is William Reichert. I am a volunteer with the Minnesota Voters Alliance. Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. For sake of time, I will abbreviate my testimony. All the text comes from the official website of the Secretary of State of Minnesota. Secretary's duties under Minnesota law, as keeper of the Great Seal of the State of Minnesota, the Secretary of State files and certifies the authenticity of a wide variety of official documents. He also runs a statewide voter registration system and prepares official rosters for voters for every election. The chief election official, he chairs the canvassing board and certifies elections. Again, the Secretary of State is charged by law with certifying the authenticity of official documents. Are not voter registrations and ballots cast in official elections some of the most important documents to be certified as authentic under the Secretary of State's watch? Having voters show an official approved ID will assist and aid the Secretary of State in the process of certifying the authenticity of these most important documents. Should the citizens of Minnesota expect anything less from the excellent public service and credibility from the Office of the Secretary of State? And I disagree the dollar should be the motivating factor for denying or approving. Thank you very much. Any questions?
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, sir. Here's what we're going to do now.
Mr. Chairman.
Excuse me. Senator Cohen.
I was going to ask a question of the witness.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, sir, what is the Minnesota Voters Alliance?
Minnesota Voters Alliance.
Mr. Reichert.
Yes, thank you. Senator Cohen, Minnesota Voters Alliance is a nonprofit organization that we take no money for this. Personally, we are, our goal is to strengthen the voice of the voters. So,
all right. And Mr. Chairman, just to follow up.
Senator Cohen.
Just two quick questions. Is it a 501c3, and how many members belong to the alliance?
Mr. Reichert.
Is it 501c4.
Thank you.
And how many members belong to the alliance?
That is not public information. I'm not privy to that information right at this point.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you
for
Chair.
Your testimony. Committee, here's what we're going to do at this point. We are going to a vote, but I am going to allow committee members to make a final comment if you would like before we take that vote. We're done with our public testimony, and we will be taking a vote here very shortly. So, Senator Goodwin, you had...
I have a comment. Mr. Chair, I'd like to make a motion to lay this on the table, and I want to explain why. Because this is the State Government Committee, and this is the place to hear this thoroughly. And I know there are other people that would like to talk on this bill. And if we're putting constitutional amendments on the ballot because we want to hear from the people, then let's start that process here in this room. And let people come up and testify on it, because I know there's a number of other issues that people have concern about. The other issue I'm concerned about is the fact that if we put this on the ballot.
We'll work on your, before you go any further, we need to work on your motion.
Thank you.
All right. The motion is not debatable. Roll call has been requested and granted. Again, the motion is not debatable. So we will move on. Secretary will take the roll.
Senator Carl.
The motion is to lay this on the table, to lay Senate File 1577 on the table.
Senator Carlson?
As amended.
Senator Cohen?
Yes.
Senator Daley?
No.
Senator Hayden?
Yes.
Senator Gazelka?
No.
Senator Goodwin?
No. Wait. Yes, I mean.
I was going to give you a no just to balance it out.
That's what you get for sitting next to Senator Thompson.
That's catchy.
Senator Lilly.
I believe my answer would be no.
Senator
Olson. Copycat.
No.
Senator Ortman.
No.
Senator Thompson.
No.
Senator Torres-Ray.
Yes.
Senator Wieger.
Yes.
Senator Perry.
No.
Mr. Chair.
Being there are eight no's and five yeas, the motion does not prevail. Okay, we're going to finish up, Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, and I'd like just to one more consideration for this committee is that this timeline on this is truly impossible. First of all, I like the points that were made that we don't know the details of this, and this is much more important, much bigger to our freedom and democracy than the environmental amendment that went on the ballot or other things. So I don't think there's any way we can put the laws together for that if it passes next session and get it done by the end of May. So you've got a June 13th or 15th date on this, and it still has to go through a rulemaking process, and there's no way that we can implement this by the date that Senator Newman wants it done by. So that's a big consideration, folks. We can't do it in that amount of time.
Thank you. Before I go to Senator Cohen, for those of you that would like to provide some testimony, you can provide it to my office, and it will be put online. If somebody did have something here that was not specific to what we were looking at. Senator Cohen.
Mr. Chairman, just very quickly, I believe Senator Newman is authoring this for from his perspective, very positive and good motives from his perspective. I don't in any way impugn his authorship of this legislation nor the support of members of this committee. But I've served in this legislature for a long time. And I'll be honest, Mr. Chairman, I've authored some legislation that, in retrospect, I don't think was very good legislation to author. I've seen some bad legislation authored by Democrats. I've seen some bad legislation authored by Republicans. I think this is as egregious a piece of legislation as I've ever seen. I believe Theodore Bilbo and Benjamin Tillman would be quite proud of this legislation.
Thank you. Further comments? Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to appeal to you to have a second hearing on this bill. I think that Ms. Jackson articulated very clearly that this is under our competence. I think it's under our jurisdiction. In this new language that is proposed by Senator Newman in line 111, he is proposing that the state will issue photographic ID and make it available to all eligible individuals. That is under the jurisdiction of the state. We have to own the responsibility for that, and I believe that it is irresponsible for us to say in this committee, we're just going to approve that this goes on the ballot and we will you know, we'll figure it out later. If we put the state through a process that, you know, causes litigation problems, that causes a lot of money to the state, we really don't care right now. We want these on the ballot. I think that that is irresponsible, Mr. Chair. I think that we ought to talk about this now, because you and I will probably end up talking about this a year from now. And for us to pretend today that this is not going to be a problem for us, that we don't have to come up with money to do it, I think is incredibly irresponsible. And so I would like to ask that we do have a conversation about the implementation of this law, if it becomes a law. I understand that, you know, right now we're trying to put, you know, this as a constitutional amendment that the public will decide. Well, when the public decides, we own that responsibility of figuring out how to implement this. Is it responsible for us to say we're going to do 80% of this and, you know, we'll wait to see if that other 20% causes a lot of problems to the counties in terms of to the state, you know, to the Secretary of State's office? Well, you know, we're just going to pretend right now that's not a problem. Well, this is our responsibility. This is our committee's responsibility. And I would like to ask, Mr. Chairman, that we do have that conversation before we move this piece of legislation.
Thank you very much, and your comment is well taken. Senator Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your leniency today. I know that at some level you really wanted to wrap up before now, but I will say this, Mr. Chair, that I agree with my colleague, Senator Torres Ray, and Senator Goodwin, that the people haven't been heard on this bill. That, you know, I know that we had 5 hours of testimony in a committee, but the bill changed, and there hasn't been an opportunity. And frankly, Mr. Chair, to only to not have the people who want to come in, all of the various groups on both sides, the groups that have organizations that we don't know who their members are and that are a political organization, then there are some that are on the other side of that would really like to make a point out of this issue. I think about this issue around the provisional ballot specifically. I remember hearing this bill in the House, if I can recall those days long ago when I was in the House of Representatives, Mr. Chair, in which some of my outstate rural members talked about in Duluth, in St. Louis County, where Duluth is the county seat. In St. Louis County, it may be, I don't know, some people may know, 5 or 6 hours, you know, from one side of the county to the other. And someone testified that they may live in the northwest corner of St. Louis County and give their provisional ballot or don't have the right ID or whatever, all of the things that we now need to put people through in which to vote, and that they would then have to figure out how to get their ID and then make that trip all the way to Duluth in order for their ballot to be counted. So I know that probably some of this has been in the testimony before. I know when we heard the bill last year, I heard a lot of that. But I still think that we need to give this bill an opportunity to really be heard thoroughly. We still have some time yet in this legislative session. And to be quite frank with you, Mr. Chair, we haven't done a lot of work. You know, now I don't know if that's because I'm in the upper house now and we kind of streamlined this process, but I think that we have the time. I don't see what the rush, I don't see what the sense of urgency is. I think that we need to give everybody an opportunity each time that we change this bill to sit down with you and Senator Newman and to be heard. And there is no guarantee that once we get to finance that people will be heard. And then ultimately when we get to the Senate floor, then we know that the people can't testify there. As a matter of fact, in the Senate, they can't even be recognized and being there. That's just part of our rules and customs. So I just will appeal to you and really want to have us think about how can we be heard, how can people be heard, and we need to go through this bill piece by piece, inch by inch, to ensure that we really understand the far-reaching implications of what this bill will do if it becomes law.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Hayden. Senator Daley.
Senator Newman, thank you for all the efforts you put into this. Thank you for bringing this to us. I move that Senate File 1577 as amended be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance.
On the daily motion, all those...
Mr. Chair?
I want a roll call, yes.
Roll call has been requested and will be granted. Secretary will take
Mr.
the
Chair?
Roll.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Wigger?
Yes. Briefly, Mr. Chair, whatever the cost is, which still needs to be determined, I believe is a waste of money in a time of tight resources. The case has not been made that there's this rampant voter fraud in the state. And I feel it's going to, if approved, ultimately disenfranchise tens of thousands of people, and then you'll have to deal with that. And for anyone whose right to vote is going to be suppressed, I say that is disgraceful.
Thank you. Secretary, take the roll.
Senator Carlson.
Yes.
Senator Cohen.
No.
Senator Daley.
Yes.
Senator Hayden.
No.
Senator Gazelka.
Yes.
Senator Goodwin.
No.
Senator Lilly.
Yes.
Senator Olson.
Yes.
Senator Ortman.
Yes.
Senator Thompson.
Yes.
Senator Torres Ray.
No.
Senator Wieger.
No.
Senator Perry.
Yes. On a 8 yes and 5 no's, Senate File 1577 passes and will be re-referred to Finance. Thank you. As amended. Next on our list is Senate File 1631. I believe that's Senator Lilly.
He banged it down, didn't he?
Oh, there it is.
Okay. No. I wanted it.
Okay. All right, thank you.
This is not the we don't have that the idea.
Senator Lilly, we're gonna wait just a couple of minutes while people clear out.
We're trying.
No.
I did not draft this, by the way, but
impediment.
I guess there is.
He's got a bill up today, and me too. Mine is going to is focused on protect. We've just got to get a few things out there because something's got to happen.
Can't see anything but 1631.
I'll get one for the judge too.
Didn't it get laid on the table? I thought you're. I think you're right, but I think it got laid on the table.
Yeah. Just vote it out. Got the vote. Stick on.
Oh, great.
Assume that you have some input in, Drew.
Yes.
That's your hunting piece.
This, I believe, is already in there. It's restated.
Yeah, sure.
All right. The second item on the agenda is Senate File 1631, Senator Lilly, State Agency's Rulemaking Temporary Moratorium. Senator Lilly, I believe you have an author's amendment.
I do. I would like to move the A3 amendment, please.
All those in favor of the A3 amendment signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Amendment prevails to the amended bill.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you very much. I believe that we have a bill here that clearly does fall under the purview of this committee. Hopefully we will not have questions in that vein on this particular bill.
Well, one of the things that we have faced as we went around the state this summer in the Jobs Committee, meeting with job creators across the state, is that during these meetings, businesses were frustrated with the fact that the rules continue to change in which they operate their businesses, the rules that are implemented by state agencies and by this legislature. And they were looking for basically a timeout. They were looking for a way that we could pull back on the rulemaking that we put in place that impact those businesses. What we're looking for is a little bit of certainty for businesses, a little bit of clarity so that they can understand what environment they're working under as far as rules. One of the things that they face is that as the rules keep changing, they are not investing in their businesses to create jobs. They're trying to pay down their debts. They're trying to do other things with their capital, and we would like to free them up to be able to invest more in their businesses. Senate File 1631 provides for a two-year moratorium on agencies' rulemaking authority. And there are a number of exemptions or off-ramps to this rulemaking moratorium, and we will get into more details on those. But truly, this bill, the purpose of this bill, is to send an instant message to our job creators that we are serious about making Minnesota a great place to grow jobs and to grow your business and to invest in this state. As we're having this conversation, I do want to point out that governors from Arizona, Washington, North Carolina, and New Jersey have all issued executive orders that do exactly this, that place a moratorium on rulemaking in those states. Again, trying to send that message to job creators that it is a good place to grow jobs in their state. Our job creators face a total maze of rules, and I'm sure that we will hear testimony about some of those rules and how they are applied, sometimes inconsistently, that sometimes businesses face different types of rules depending who from the agencies come in and talk with them. So today I've asked Judge Lippman to come in and join us to talk about our authority as far as the legislature for rulemaking. And I'd like him to share some information about that. And I believe in your packet you have some information from the judge.
Mr. Chairman, could I?
Senator Olson.
Could I just ask a question of clarification? Does this apply to all agencies or just those that are dealing with business and job creation?
All agencies.
Senator Lilly.
Mr. Chair, all agencies.
So,
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Lilly, you've been talking only about job creation, but, you know, all of our education rules are not necessarily related to that at all. But it is encompassing. I notice your statements do appear to apply if you just leave out that job creation portion of it. And that's why I was wondering if you were limiting it, because we had some concerns about coming in and redoing when that wasn't the statutory directive.
Senator Lilly.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson. I was hoping to get into more detail about that as the conversation progressed.
But I've got to go to committee that I'm chairing.
Okay, but if we look at the actual bill, Senate File 1631, there is a good clause exemption that is listed there, and it lists a number of areas, and I guess I could go through those right now quickly, but relating to a serious or immediate threat to public safety is one of the exemptions or off-ramps. Another one is relating to compliance with court order or requirement in federal law. Another one is relating to the incorporation of specific changes set forth in statute, in other words, what the legislature acts upon, and then relating to changes that do not alter the sense, meaning, or effect of a rule. And this does not limit obsolete rulemaking, so eliminating obsolete rulemaking. And the amendment that was just voted on also looks at Section 14.386, which relates to some gaming and fishing and hunting rules and some of those types of things. So, again, there are, Senator Olson, off-ramps for a number of areas, and we as a legislature can continue to assist in the rulemaking, and your committee will continue to be able to do that as we move forward. But if I could refer back to the judge.
Sure. Your Honor, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Eric Lippman. I'm the Assistant Chief Administrative Law Judge at the Minnesota Office of Administrative Hearings. Senator Lilly wanted me to reprise three slides from a presentation I gave last January because there might have been a little lapse in memory, but I just wanted to give an overall context. Senator Lilly asked me to make this presentation in the Jobs Committee, thought it was helpful if we reprised it here in State Gov. I'm going to start very briefly and just mindful of the hour. Bring you back to your seventh grade civics class. Thomas Jefferson wrote in the Declaration of Independence that we're endowed by our Creator with inalienable rights and that governments are instituted amongst men so as to preserve those rights. There's the same similar provision in the beginning of the Minnesota State Constitution, which suggests that all political power is inherent in the people and that they create a state government under the Constitution to preserve those rights and preserve liberty for their posterity. So if we made pictures about that, we start with Mr. Jefferson's delegations boxes, or it could be the territorial Minnesotans' delegation boxes. God goes to the voters, to whom all political power is inherent, so there's no restrictions. The voters give their political power to those very good-looking people on the Senate floor, but there are some restrictions.
Your Honor?
Yes.
Excuse me, but I noticed you cut me out of the picture.
Oh, with regret, Mr. Chairman. I didn't mean to. The voters of your district gave you a limited range of powers, whether you're in the picture or not.
Thank you. Thank you, sir.
We'll get a legal size next time, I promise. So the voters give legislative power or political power to the members of the Senate, but there are constrictions. Tax bills have to start in the House. There has to be a majority vote. There has to be presentation for ordinary legislation to the governor within certain time frames. The Senate doesn't decide exactly how it's going to promulgate new law. There are certain restrictions, all of which are found in Article is it Article 3?
Yes. Forgive me.
In the lawmaking power. So then the box that we're talking about today is the further delegation from the legislature to executive branch agencies to make administrative rules, which have the force and effect of law, that are just as binding as any statute. And there are a series of conditions that you'll place on that lawmaking power. The reasons why there are conditions, I talk about the tale of two desks. If you go to the second one, Office Space A, and I hope, Mr. Chairman, you can be seen in this picture.
Your Honor, I can't because this is a picture, I believe it's 2010.
That's an old picture.
Yes, it is.
Good old days.
Well, I was going to say when we were I was in the minority.
Okay. So Office Space A is populated. The folks at those desks are selected by the voters on the ballot. They have election certificates. Their proceedings when they vote and amend legislation are televised. More transparency than some of the drafting of administrative rules, not all, but some of the drafting, which occurs in Office Space B. I'm just taking this as the average cube in an executive branch agency, by folks who may well not be known, well known to the voters, who, while do undertake their work as in part of a public process, are not necessarily selected by the voters, and don't certainly oftentimes do that work when they're drafting or adopting orders on television. So there are a series of conditions that the legislature makes on the exercise of lawmaking power when it's done by executive branch officials. It's in Chapter 14, and some of those strings that we attach are on the third page. The public notice process, whether it's an invitation to hearing. Also, there's notice of proposed rulemaking that's done to people who sign up and want to receive notices from various state agencies. Also, there's a requirement in standard rulemaking that the agencies go out and search for folks who are likely to be impacted by those rules and let them know, even if they have another earlier enrolled. There's the detail of the statement of need and reasonableness. They have a detailed memo with required elements that the agency needs to address. Those agencies need to prove up their rule by an affirmative presentation of facts, particularly in the OAH, and the citizens don't just take the agency's word for it. They have to have some reasons why they're making the policy choice that they do. There's an independent review of the proposed rules and their compliance with the procedural steps by somebody who's independent of the agency, an administrative law judge at the Office of Administrative Hearings. And then there's a political check at the end of the process by the governor, presumably having a veto if he or she, whoever the governor is at the time, finds that the rules are defective or not in the best interest of the policy. And so that is an overview of the process, which again suggests that because the delegation by the voters was made to you, and you control the delegation in favor of executive branch agencies, that as long as you're operating within your constitutional powers, I think the key point for this committee is you can establish the rulemaking process in any way that you see fit.
Thank you very much. I guess we do have one other testifier here today, Mr. Jerry Zest Markets, I believe.
Mr. Chair, may I ask Judge Lippman a question?
Yes, you may. Your Honor, just sit right beside Mr. Zest. And Senator Wigger.
Yes, thank you. Mr. Chair, and Judge Lippman, if this became law, would there be less appropriation for your agency?
Your Honor,
Senator Wigger, we've priced that this would be a, I think it's a roughly $137,000 decrease in the revenues to our agency, at least the Administrative Law Division. As members may well know, the Office of Administrative Hearings, Administrative Law Division, works on a revolving fund. We charge an hourly rate that's approved by the Minnesota Management and Budget to the state agencies to whom we work. This would obviously be a constriction of the rulemaking petitions that we review, that legal review that I was talking about a few moments ago. We price the reduction to our agency of $137,000 over a two-year period of the work that we would ordinarily do if rulemaking petitions were coming in for review. I hope that's clear.
Senator Wigger. Okay. Please state your name, and you may proceed.
Well, thanks for inviting me. My name's Jerry Zube. I'm down in Rochester. I run a place now currently called Zest Market, and that's how things got turned around.
Well, thank you. That's only the second time this week that I've had the last name wrong. And the previous one was a former state senator. So, but thank you anyway.
I appreciate the invitation here. I believe that a solution of 80% of identifying a problem is the solution to it. My grandfather, father, and one and only brother had 100 years in IBM, but I was the black sheep of the family. I started washing dishes when I was 15. This is my 40th year in the restaurant business. In that time, I've owned and operated 16 restaurants, 13 I built from the ground up, or 13 I built, two from the ground up. I had a seafood market, which did wholesale and retail. I've managed a couple of different restaurants, including one in Walt Disney World. I've been a paid consultant to different restaurateurs, including Walt Disney World, which was great because now I understand Dilbert cartoons. I sold my restaurants to my business partner's kids. I was happily retired for 2 weeks, and then my wife got this idea to do this market, this last one, Zest. And so I'm kind of back in the saddle. Full disclosure, I'm a capitalist. I believe in personal freedoms and personal responsibilities. I believe that small businesses are the heartbeat of our country, and that's what makes the things grow. I believe that me in my dining room with customers on one side and staff on the other puts me in the best position to know what's best for the market and how I can achieve prosperity and make this whole thing work. Over the years, I've experienced an absolute army of bureaucrats and an alphabet soup of bureaucracies. There's building and safety that comes with the electrical inspector we lovingly refer to as His Majesty. There's the plumbing department, mechanical department for the heating, ventilating, and air conditioning, fire department, ADA, weights and measures, sales tax department, liquor inspector, Department of Public Safety, and, of course, our health department. Restaurants are especially diversely regulated, but I guess we touch on so many different issues. I don't have anybody there from the Nuclear Waste Commission, and otherwise it's pretty much everybody has their sights on me. Every one of these agencies is an impediment to business. Some of them are a bump in the road. Some of them are a brick wall you can't go under, around, over, or through. They all give great reasons for why we need to do what we need to do. I don't know. I have some examples here. I told my host that I would keep this to under 3 hours, so I whittled it down to just the highlights. I've had the health department on their hands and knees looking down my floor drains with a flashlight, writing me up for violations of the health code for public safety issues. Weights and Measures was in and found out one of my scales was 3/1,000ths of a pound underweight. So when they put their 20-pound weight on there, it only registered 19.997, which was out of tolerance, so they red-flagged it, and I had to pay to have the thing fixed and recalibrated. Yes, I'm losing money on that deal, and since we're not selling gold, when we sell prosciutto, it didn't really matter a whole lot, but whatever. A liquor permit must be posted conspicuously because the public has a right to know who they're doing business with. My wife and I standing there all day, every day, apparently doesn't qualify. Liquor invoices have to be on the premises because the liquor inspector claims that he doesn't want to go somewhere else to look up the invoices if he's doing a check on some other operation. For instance, if he wants to make sure that we're paying the same for our beer as everybody else. When you have multiple restaurants that are all operated by one office, that makes it difficult. But somehow, I guess, with our drowning in debt and unemployment through the roof and all that, we can sleep better knowing that Haskell's pays the same for Budweiser as Certix does. I built a pizza parlor a while ago, and I wanted to put in a wood-burning oven, which was referred to as a solid-fueled cooking appliance. Solid fuel conjured up images to me of NASA and all, but we're talking this, like wood, solid-fueled. They insisted that I put a sprinkler head inside of my oven. That delayed our project for about 3 months. Now, I want fire in my oven. It cooks pizzas a lot better that way. But we went through all kinds of discourse on that. I got a hold of several suppliers of solid-fueled ovens, and they showed us thousands of them across the country, including the Punch restaurants here in town, Walt Disney World and all. The answer from the inspector was, existence in other jurisdictions is not evidence of compliance with the code. So my 6,500-pound oven was delayed for months trying to get the appropriate permits. Eventually they acquiesced, but we had to put in a garden hose next to the oven so that if for some reason this thing burned out of control, I was supposed to have one of my 17-year-old minimum-wage people douse this thing with a garden hose. Now, if I have a 6,500-pound brick and cement oven burning wild, which it normally operates at 900 degrees, burning wildly out of control, it would quickly become 6,500 pounds of gravel if I did that, and I wouldn't want to be within 100 yards of it, but that's what we did. In the same place, we had a light switch that was 12 feet in the air that controlled the front sign that the electrical inspector, my buddy, made us put a locking box on it because apparently that was another safety risk. And when I ask the question, the answers always start with what if. And in this case, it was what if somebody's out front working on the sign and what if somebody inside flips on this switch. It's 12 feet in the air. But I paid my master electrician to hop in his pickup truck, run to the parts store, get a cover so that we could put a locking cover over this thing. So now we don't have to worry about that problem anymore. A lot of times it's ambiguous language in the rules and random interpretations. Sometimes it's language so specific there's just no wiggle room for any other options. My father always brought home his Think magazine, which was IBM's slogan, and sometimes there's just no options for that. Sometimes you get conflicting regulations. The liquor inspector on one inspection was telling me about the people working there under 18 years old. And I said, what about my kids? And his words were, you can treat your kids like slaves. That doesn't apply in your business. Great. So I had my 14-year-old bussing tables a couple hours a day in my restaurant, which I'm proud of the restaurant and teach him some values and having a job and all that. And then the labor department found out and fined us $3,500.
Mr. Sube.
Yes.
I love all your examples, but our time is running short. As a person that owns a pizza place, I get it. I understand what you're saying, and I really truly I could listen to you all day. But could you, if you have a summary statement, because I do have another testifier, and we have to be out of here in about 8 minutes.
Everything that you do has a huge impact on us. It's it's the totality of all these regulations that makes it almost, and I'm not impugning these people or their departments, they're doing their job, but when they do their job, I can't do my job. And from my angle, it seems like every time I see a light at the end of the tunnel, the politicians run out and buy more tunnel. And I'm just asking you, please don't do that. Let me get my feet on the ground and get this thing going.
Thank you very much for being here today. It takes a lot to say what you have said. We've seen citizens coming forward with the same concerns, and I really appreciate your time, Mr. Zube. Thank you. Mr. Meyer?
Mr. Chairman, members, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. I'd also like to bring up Mr. Rajakowski from the Department of Labor and Industry. He has some specific examples of the impacts of this bill. While he's doing that, I do appreciate the author's amendment to allow for the hunting and fishing rules to proceed, but we do still have concerns about what the bill does. It doesn't repeal any rules. It just stops any rules from being made, and Mr. Rajakowski will get into that in a moment. But right now, the administration is undertaking a continuous improvement effort, looking at how can we create jobs, remove barriers, things like that, and putting a two-year moratorium would cause impacts to that opportunity for us. So while it does stop bad rules from moving forward, it also prohibits good rules from happening as well. So in our case, rules for a wolf hunting season, unless we're specifically stated, would probably be impacted, probably not now with the amendment, I should say, but we have concerns about that. But aquatic invasive species rules that we need to possibly implement to control Asian carp or zebra mussels, unless it's determined a public health and safety issue, and I think it's unclear in the bill how that would be determined right now, we would be prohibited from doing so. So rather than talk about stopping all rulemaking, we would like to have a discussion about what rules are impeding commerce right now. Are there rules that are impeding commerce? And let's have a healthy discussion about making things better, bipartisanly. I think everybody can agree to that. Stopping all rulemaking isn't the answer, in our opinion. And just briefly, Mr. Chair, I'm not going to hand this letter out, but last session, Governor Dayton did veto House File 2203, which dealt with legislative approval. But in his veto letter, he talked about the fact that the legislature has the authority to change or amend existing rule through legislation. Existing law, which allows the legislature to essentially override any rule passed by an agency, would seem to provide ample protections against overly burdensome or unnecessary rules. And in his closing statement, Governor Dayton says, "I will strongly safeguard the long-established principles of executive agency rulemaking and regulatory authority." I get and I appreciate what the bill tries to do, and I've talked to the author about that, but let's have a healthy debate about rules that we do need to change rather than stopping all rulemaking into the future. Thank you.
Thank you. Please state your name and proceed.
Mr. Chairman, I'm John Rakowski with the Department of Labor and Industry, and the commissioner has asked me to testify on his behalf. The same bill is over in the House at about the same time, so mm-hmm. We're splitting time. Our department, for those who aren't familiar, do basically four statutory functions: workers' compensation, we do labor standards, and I'll have a discussion with the gentleman after the committee here. We also regulate the construction industry, and we're a state-run OSHA plan for the feds. I'm going to touch on a couple of workers' comp rules that would be negatively impacted by this, and may I add that it would not just impact the department. Every fall in October of 1st, by law, we need to update the medical fee schedules for doctors and pharmacists for their payments for work comp claims. We have to adjust the fee on an annual basis. And this, according to our deputy commissioner, who is a very trained attorney, would not meet the just cause clause. So we would be inviting certain litigation. Also, the OSHA standards, it's not clear. Standards is the federal term for rules. The feds would. I also got an email from the rules coordinator at the Department of Human Services, and there are some federal requirements that the department must do, as well as us for OSHA, by the feds. So it's not clear if we are told to stop making rules for the next 2 years what the feds are going to react to. At our department, our department has jurisdiction over the construction industry, and we have authoritative boards for plumbing, electrical, and high-pressure piping. And those boards are made up of contractors who are actually out in the business. These are business people who, of their own time, come to the department to upgrade or update, the plumbing code, the electrical code, and the high-pressure piping code. Right now, the plumbing code has three active rulemaking procedures, and that would be stopped in its tracks. And most importantly, in the interest of time, the overall statewide building code hasn't been updated in 6 years for a variety of reasons. That's not a shell, that's a may. We're in the process, we're just beginning the process of adopting the state building code, and there's over 200 business people who are taking time away from their work to come down as members of technical advisory committees to make sure this code is as up-to-date as it can be and allow for new products to be on the market. I'll point out that the state of Wisconsin is also adopting the 2012 building code, and we put Minnesota at a serious disadvantage. And that's my comments to that.
Thank you, Senator Lilly.
Mr. Chair, members, I sincerely appreciate the testimony of these folks from the agencies and the testimony of our friend from Rochester, Mr. Zubay. But the truth is, when in listening to the business owners' frustration at dealing with agencies and rulemaking, the system is broken. The system is not working. We are not doing what we should be doing, and one of the challenges is that, and I believe that we heard testimony from Commissioner Peterson that he has never this was earlier this week, we heard that he has never been confronted or asked by anybody to reduce a rule or to eliminate a rule. And here we have a business person that comes forward and can list them and could probably go on for quite a bit longer, so I'm not sure that we're asking that question. But the corollary to that, and I'm going to ask Mr. Rajkowski to take a look at this, in your packets is Senate File 1717, which is a bill that was presented in the Jobs Committee. Senator Miller has this bill, and it is the Dolley Agency Bill. Mm-hmm. And on the back page of it is the repealer. So in all the documents, all the rules, all the code of this agency during the past year, this is what was found to be repealed in the whole agency for the whole year. And if I could summarize my understanding, and you please correct me if I'm wrong, of these rules that are here, 1301.1201 is a renumbering. It is still in the document someplace else, in statute someplace else. Same with 1302.006. The balance of those are all already in the electrical code. So in the whole year, we were not able to repeal a single statute rule for the whole agency of Dolley. And I would be interested in doing the same exercise with most of our other agencies and finding out what have we actually repealed throughout the year. And I think the facts will bear that we're not going through this process and we're not making recommendations to repeal.
Thank you. Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of things come to me. One is listening to why we shouldn't do this really sort of makes the point as to why we should do it. That there is so much to be done that we have to keep doing it. And that's the problem, is we're trying to do too much for too many people. The second thing is, listening to the gentleman, Mr. Zuboy, I think I got that name right, testify. It's obvious these agencies have incredible amounts of knowledge. They understand that there needs to be sprinklers here and hoses there. But I was kind of reminded of what my son says to illustrate the difference between knowledge and wisdom. Knowledge is the awareness that tomatoes are a fruit. Wisdom is not putting tomatoes in a fruit salad. And so the problem we have with our agencies is there's all kinds of knowledge, but there's very little wisdom. And so when I look at this legislation and I see the four exceptions relating to a serious or immediate threat to the public health, safety, or welfare, relating to compliance with a court order, et cetera, I look at this list and I go, why are we making rules that don't fit into this? I think this would be a pretty good set of guidelines to go by ad infinitum. So I commend Senator Lilly for the bill. I think that if you talk to businessmen and women around the state, you will find that that many times these regulatory agencies are nameless, faceless, you know, animals that impede their ability to do business. No rap on the individuals doing the work. I'm in a business that oftentimes individuals are forced to do things as part of our job that, you know, institutionally we're compelled to do. And the same is true for the folks, I'm sure, that are enforcing these rules. The problem is that it is the system that is broken. And I think putting the brakes on the system for a couple of years makes a lot of sense.
All right. Thank you very much. Thanks to our testifiers.
Thank you.
Before Senator Lilly, I know, wants to move the bill, I'll just like to say that thank you for this. I truly believe that the only way that we will move forward is for the legislators to take back the authority that they so wantonly wanted to get rid of. And until we do that, I don't believe there'll be the type of accountability that needs to be when we look at rulemaking. And finally, I think with a two-year moratorium, that will give our agencies plenty of time to look at the rules and talk with the citizens about how those rules are truly affecting business. So with that, Senator Lilly.
Mr. Chair, members, I do believe that businesses do play by the rules. They try to play by the rules, and they are not looking for massive changes to the statutes. They're just looking for a timeout, a two-year timeout. So I move that Senate File 1631, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance.
On the Lilly motion, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. It will be re-referred. Members that are still – thank you, Senator Lilly. Members that are still here – just so you know, I've sent Senate File 651, the tele-network bill from Senator Michelle Benson, to the Subcommittee on Reform and Redesign, because I believe it's going to be discussed in the committee sometime in the near future. With that, there being no further business, this committee is adjourned.